I'd like to begin with a reading, and it's from Joseph Campbell. And if you're old like me, you'll remember The Power of Myth with Bill Moyers on PBS. And this is from that. You can tell what's informing a society by what the tallest building is. When you approach a medieval town, the cathedral is the tallest thing in the place. When you approach an 18th century town, it is the political palace that's the tallest thing in the place. And when you approach a modern city, the tallest places are the office buildings, the centers of economic life. If you go to Salt Lake City, you see the whole thing illustrated right in front of your face. First, the temple was built right in the center of the city. This is the proper organization, because the temple is the spiritual center from which everything flows in all directions. Then the political building, the Capitol, was built beside it, and it's taller than the temple. And now the tallest building is the office building that takes care of the affairs of both the temple and the political building. That's the history of Western civilization. From the Gothic through the princely periods of the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries to this economic world that we're in now. And let's acknowledge that in the past few years, this world has been changing with the speed of light and is disconcerting for many. Society created religion because we need a social heart, a commonly held set of values defining how we should relate. Without such a defining heart, there is no code, no system of community justice, no bonding of social life. There is only the excesses of self-centered individualism. And may I propose that we're doing that right now. When's the last time you heard someone talk about ethics? The fact that religion has become an impotent institution in Western culture, and we have, is not due to a change in its purpose or its necessity. It is because religion has failed to speak and to model a message which is relevant to present human need. I believe that we Unitarian Universalists fall under this judgment. Otherwise, we would see our values reflected in the social heartbeat. Now, there was a time in American history when Unitarians and Universalists did provide the social heartbeat. It was during the latter part of the 1700s and the first part of the 1800s. This was the time when our values provided the ideology which birthed our nation and shaped our Constitution that's hanging on for its life right now. However, for a variety of reasons, which is a whole nother sermon, our heartbeat grew faint. It was replaced by the stronger one of conservative Christianity. During the Second World War and in the 1950s, it appeared that Christianity had forever won the nation's heart. This proved to be an illusion. For what appeared to be a strong heartbeat was the result of a temporary shot of social adrenaline. This made Christianity's heart to appear stronger than it actually was. And that adrenaline was a nation's sense of gratitude to Christianity's God for enabling us to win the Second World War. But underneath this surface, the surface of this illusion, a new set of values were emerging, which would become the heartbeat of American culture. The Vietnam War provided the occasion for its rise to dominance. With the Reagan presidency, it reigns supreme as the moral heart of our nation. This new heartbeat has not come to us under the guise of religion, although it has usurped the role of religion because of the impotence of religion. Its face is the American corporation. That's our moral heart. Its fundamental philosophy is geared to its definition of human worth. In a general sense, human worth is defined by social and economic status. In a specific sense, human worth is defined by contribution to the gross national product. Why am I sharing these perceptions? Because I believe, despite our proclamation of principles that stand against this corporate model, we have been giving ourselves permission for some time to be subtly co-opted in our community life by the corporate model of our culture. It began with the Cultural Revolution of the 1960s, which ushered in a furious negative reaction to religion. In our churches, the ground of this reaction was our confusion that being religious and being Orthodox were the same thing. I heard it all the time. We began purging ourselves of all things which reminded us of religion, language, ritual, financial stewardship, and even those principles which govern all institutional success, simply because they were used by the Orthodox and very successfully. But above all else, we converted our religious purpose into a self-serving, eternal goal, that of creating fellowship for frustrated liberals. Anytime one of our congregations took a membership survey to rank its values, you always knew that the top value, the word at the top of the list, would be what? Fellowship. And it still is. Back then, to protect this fellowship from the encroachment of new members, we began debating about limiting the size of our memberships. We really did do that. Nobody ever debates that if they're invested in their purpose. Size is not an issue when you're invested in your purpose. To emphasize this sanctuary posture, many of our congregations constructed or purchased buildings in the woods, old houses that didn't look like churches, or any place else that might be hidden from public view. We, not so much. We're right on the square. But what happened to us is we began to exist for the sake of ourselves. And then struggle with purpose and mission. Whatever message we had was about who we were not rather than who we are. We practiced a theology of negation. We preferred to be socially respectable rather than to be religious. With this conversion of purpose, we turned to the corporate model to organize ourselves. And I remember this really clearly because it's right in the middle of my career. We adopted its cost-effective language. Institutional maintenance replaced our daring of vision. We imported its super rational approach to reality, and the mystery of life became hidden to our eyes. Clergy often viewed themselves as chief executive officers. In short, we traded the religious model with its collective focus and generosity of spirit for the corporate model with its individualized focus and self-centered spirit. For if we are modeling the secular mentalities with which people must contend in the rest of the culture, what appeal is that? The power to transform the social heart lies in two areas. First, in proclaiming a message relevant to current human need. Second, in modeling how that message works in community living. If the relevant human need is for a different way of relating than that offered by the corporate model of our culture, then the message we model must be different than the secular one. I believe if we are to truly model the religious principles we proclaim, the visible characteristics of our community living would correspond to these commitments. And I'm referring to our principles in the front of the hymnal. One, a commitment to the equal worth of every member, irrespective of economic and social status. Two, a commitment to the ecological principle that what's best for the whole is the same as what's best for the part. We struggle with that. What's best for the whole and not the individual. That's pushing us. Three, a commitment to the democratic process is the only fair and equal way of making community decisions. Four, a commitment to religious purpose is the only valid measure of the success or failure of the congregation's ministry. Five, a commitment to the belief that power shared is power multiplied. And last, a commitment to a profound form of trust, of mutual trust, between congregation and minister. Think about the transforming power of this kind of community model. Think about its appeal to people who must contend with the corporate heartbeat. The purpose of this kind of community model is to create behavior which makes our congregations a different place to be. That's it in a nutshell. A different place to be. And if we are to become a different place to be in the world, then we must live our message in such a manner, that we dramatically and profoundly affect each other. Let me illustrate with a story that a lot of you are most likely aware of. There was a famous monastery that had fallen on hard times. Once its many buildings were filled with young monks and its big church resounded with the singing of chants, but now it was deserted. People no longer came to be nourished by its spiritual power. Only a handful of old monks shuffled through its cloisters with heavy hearts. On the edge of the woods by the monastery, an old rabbi built a little hut. He would come there occasionally to fast and to pray. No one ever spoke to him. But whenever he appeared, the word would pass from monk to monk. The rabbi walks in the woods. As long as he was there, the monks were sustained by his presence. One day, the abbot decided to visit the rabbi and open his heart to him. As he approached the hut, He saw the rabbi standing in the doorway, his arms outstretched in welcome. It was as though he had been waiting. The two embraced like long-lost brothers. The rabbi motioned for the abbot to enter. In the middle of the room was a table with the scriptures opened upon it. Then the rabbi lifted his head and said, "You and your brothers are serving with heavy hearts, and you have come to ask a teaching of me. I will give you a teaching, but you can only repeat it one time. After that, no one must ever repeat it aloud again. After that, no one should repeat it again." The rabbi looked into the abbot's eyes and said, "The Messiah is among you." For a while they were silent, and the rabbi said, "You must go." Next morning, the abbot gathered his monks and told them he received a teaching from the rabbi that walks in the woods. He said that the teaching must never be spoken again aloud. Then he looked at each of his brothers and said, "Rabbi said that one of us is the Messiah." Wow, the monks were startled by this teaching. What could it mean? They asked themselves. Is brother John the Messiah, or brother Matthew, or brother Thomas? Am I the Messiah? What could this mean? They're all deeply troubled by the rabbi's teaching, but no one ever mentioned it again. As time went by, the monks began to treat one another with a very special reverence. There was a gentle, wholehearted quality about them now, which was hard to describe, but easy to notice. They lived with one another as people who had finally found something, and they prayed as people who were still searching. Visitors often found themselves deeply moved by the life of these monks, and before long, people were coming from far and wide to be nourished by their spiritual practice. Young men were asking once again to become part of the community. Dear First U of Chicago, take courage, be glad. A unique and grand opportunity is before us. For the transforming power of this kind of community shall leave us standing on the side of love. Benediction is from Walt Whitman, a well-known Unitarian, considered the best poet in American letters. It's really Ralph Waldo Emerson's fault. He found Walt Whitman in a rented room with the neighbors complaining about his singing during his long baths. And he found Henry David Thoreau in his father's pencil factory. So Waldo was an amazing person. This is from Walt Whitman's poem, Song of Myself. You shall possess the origins of all poems. You shall possess the goodness of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on specters and books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself.